Chapter 29 Infatuations 1957 to 1960 Body and mind, like man and wife, do not always agree to die together. Charles C. Colton. When I was 4 years old, Baba took me onto our Giza balcony to show me the blazing Mokattam ammunitions dump. This was in 1948, during the first Arab-Israeli war. The conflict ended indecisively. The armistice agreement signed in 1949 meant Egypt remained technically at war with Israel. We were in Manchester in July 1952 when we learned from the BBC that the Free Officer Movement had deposed King Farouk. Colonel Nasser, with his junta, was in charge of Egypt. This included two junior officers, Sadat and Mubarak. Together they had served during the Arab-Israeli War. Baba, considering it progress towards a modern Egypt, had been upbeat about the news. Mother was indifferent. I overheard no debate concerning the abolishment of the monarchy or the establishment of an Egyptian republic, two topics much discussed on BBC's Radio 3. Prior to our return to Egypt, I recall no discussion following Baba's return from the London embassy with our new passports about the implications of a pro-Palestinian national agenda or the ending of Britain's 85-year occupation. In the decade of the 50s, nationalism was constantly whipped up in the government media, movies, songs, and press. The political atmosphere remained tense, with the propaganda stream against the Zionists hyped by the daily news of Egyptian commando raids launched into Israel. The pro-Palestinian agenda was to liberate occupied Arab lands. Egyptians were proud of Nasser's leadership role in the non-aligned movement, joined by Prime Minister Nehru of India, President Tito of Yugoslavia, and two-thirds of the countries in the United Nations. The movement was against the great powers, Britain and France, imperialism, colonialism, foreign aggression and domination. Their political stance was for the middle course between the Western and Eastern blocs in the Cold War. Some of my friends were ardent proponents of the military government, leading to heated playground debates. Despite Nasser's non-aligned stance, we felt assured that the World Bank would approve Egypt's 1954 request to finance the $400 million needed for the construction of the new Aswan High Dam in Upper Egypt, the cornerstone of the country's future development plan. It would control the annual Nile floods, triple the generation of hydroelectric power for industry, and increase the agricultural acreage to feed the growing population. We fervently supported these goals, which promised the modernization of a prosperous Egypt that our generation would inherit. John Foster Dulles changed my life around my 12th birthday. He recommended that the US Congress and the World Bank refuse funding the dam. In response, Nasser addressed the people of Egypt. I lay on a chaise lounge on the balcony one hot July Cairo night, watching the stars, cooled by the Mediterranean breeze that came down to Cairo from the north, listening intently to the president's lengthy speech. He declared, in colloquial Arabic, that he had nationalized the Suez Canal to finance the dam. Jubilation followed. Crowds of proud Egyptians poured into the street, celebrating. At last we could say, "Our Suez Canal." We could collect the revenue generated by the Suez Canal, about $400 million per year, allowing the High Dam project to continue. The English-language Egyptian Gazette reported anger and consternation in London and Paris at the loss of the $400 million revenue from the British and French corporation, Universal Company of the Maritime Canal of Suez. The corporation had constructed and operated the canal between the Mediterranean and the Red Sea through Egypt from 1869 until the 1956 Suez Crisis. The previous year, Nasser had closed Britain's military bases that had protected the canal during World War II and evicted British soldiers. Now Nasser had grabbed the Anglo-French canal itself. In an effort to cripple it, British and French ship pilots, who steered the oil tankers transiting the narrow canal, were promptly withdrawn. These ships guaranteed the continuous supply from the oil fields of the Middle East to European industry. Egyptian and Eastern Bloc pilots replaced them, and the canal continued to function smoothly. Revenues poured into Egyptian coffers. Egyptian nationalism soared. During this time, France supplied Israel with Mystère jets, modern fighter planes. We followed daily reports of the progress made by a French naval convoy sailing to Haifa with uranium for Israel's first atomic bomb. We worried. War tensions sharply increased when the West refused to supply Egypt with modern weapons. Czechoslovakia did, pushing Nasser into alignment with the Soviet bloc. My cousins and I watched the annual parades of Egypt's modern military might, standing in the street among the crowds, seeing rows upon rows of commando and infantry units march by. We cheered, unaware that the poorly paid conscripts had no incentive to fight. Endless columns of Soviet T-32 and T-34 tanks and armoured vehicles followed the marching men past Nasser's reviewing stand. Russian MiG-15 and MiG-17 fighter jets, accompanied by Ilyushin 18 jet bombers, flew overhead in gleaming silver formations. Our pride was palpable. To reclaim the canal and destroy the new Egyptian military, there followed the disastrous Suez War in late October 1956. Prime Minister Anthony Eden of Great Britain hatched the plan. Israel would attack Egypt by invading the Sinai, threatening normal shipping in the canal, which would limit oil supplies to the European market. The newly equipped Egyptian army advanced to Sinai to stop Israeli progress onto the canal. We listened to the BBC World Service on our little shortwave radio. A few days later, British and French forces attacked Port Said and Ismailia on the pretense of separating the fighting armies to repossess the canal. From dawn until dusk, the terrifying air raid sirens wailed as British, French, or Israeli planes attacked vital communication centres around Cairo. The military built brick walls across apartment entrance halls, converting them into air raid shelters. I snuck onto our balcony during one air raid. Across the Nile, black puffs from anti-aircraft guns filled the bright sky. I was excited. A real war. Suddenly, a high-flying silver speck exploded. A parachute emerged from the falling debris and floated downwards toward the opposite riverbank. I cheered until I saw an angry mob, like a pack of wild dogs, arms extended skyward and wielding sticks, move like a tsunami toward the descending pilot. The police reached him first, snatched the pilot in mid-air, and placed him in a protective cage. The frenzied mob surrounded it, shouting and beating it. This was the reality of war, nothing like what I had seen in movies. The Israelis, with British and French help, trapped and annihilated the Egyptian army in the Sinai, seizing the canal and humiliating President Nasser. Radio Cairo proclaimed vastly exaggerated Egyptian victories. Public knowledge of the disaster's extent led to anti-government demonstrations which failed to displace Nasser. On December 24, 1956, President Eisenhower forced the foreign troops to withdraw after Mr. Khrushchev threatened nuclear war. The lack of accountability and veracity by the Egyptian government undermined my confidence in wanting to live in a future Egypt. During the summer of 1957, smarting from the loss of my father, I rose with the Fajr prayers at 4 a.m. In the quiet hours of dawn, my recitations engendered a sense of determination. I tried to communicate with Daddy, promising him I would do my very best at school. A few days before the anniversary of his death, I always felt downhearted, the effect of my anger for his unjust punishment. I wanted him to be proud of me. My summer followed a routine that would have pleased Opa. Following prayers, I walked to the nearby Gezira Sporting and Jockey Club and swam laps in the Olympic pool, which I usually had to myself. Exhausted yet revived, I returned home around 8 for breakfast. I settled at my desk to study, including Arabic, reviewing my past lessons, preparing for the next term. Our servant made me a light lunch, and then I would nap, visit with Hassan or Assad, or go to the club seeking friends. Then came Kinga. I met her by the pool. In the blaze of afternoon light, she was a tall, slim, blonde-haired girl in a red bikini with her hair casually pinned up. About my age, she appeared unexpectedly in front of me. There was a soft, radiant vibrancy about her. She smiled at me, brightly, exposing her most unique feature, the gap between her upper front teeth. We introduced ourselves. Her little sister tried to pull her into the water, though she continued looking at me with interest. She was Hungarian. I was smitten. She spread a large red towel in the shadow of a tree, inviting me to join her. She propped herself up on her left elbow, innocently exaggerating her slim figure like no Egyptian girl would, comfortable in her body. We told each other our stories without haste the whole afternoon. She lived on the east bank of the Danube in Pest, the more affluent part of Budapest. I had nearly forgotten the annoying little sister she was babysitting. I savoured the tone of her voice and every word uttered from her delectable lips. She attended the American school. We did not have mutual friends. We parted, and I hoped to see her again. Fortunately, I encountered her at the club with daily anticipatory joy. We spent the summer afternoons getting to know each other and became fast friends. She taught me Szeretlek, Hungarian for I love you. I taught her the same phrase in Arabic, Behebbek. How easy it was to fall in love. I learned she was not a morning person. On the afternoons she did not appear at the club, I frantically searched the grounds, wanting her. Not finding her, I would worry she had forsaken me. I adoringly called her Pussy, a term of endearment, for she seemed exquisitely soft, gentle, like a kitty, and as I had first read in Leah's poem, The Owl and the Pussycat, not knowing it had a sexual connotation. One day, when I visited their home to present her with a model plane, her mother asked me why I called her daughter that. She could see from my gooiness that I was a very romantic 13. Her father, the commercial attaché at the Hungarian embassy, asked if I would like to come with them to Agami, an exclusive beach community west of Alexandria, where they had rented a house. I could sleep in the guest house. Without hesitation, I agreed. Mother was surprised. I didn't know you had a girlfriend. There was a lot I kept from Mother. I spent 4 days on the soft yellow beach under a bright blue umbrella with her parents and her annoying 8-year-old sister. I chatted with her father, who seemed to miss having a son. We kidded around. His wife rebuked him when, laughingly, he taught me some naughty Hungarian words. Kinga rarely joined us until 11 in the morning, when we would go for a walk along the firm sand, the rolling waves rushing in to cool our feet. I was love-struck by her smile, the gap in her teeth, and her blonde hair, but too proper to hold her hand, let alone to try doing more than that. Her father was recalled to Hungary, and Kinga threw a huge party. We danced to songs by the Everly Brothers, Neil Sedaka, and Paul Anka. She was a party girl. She danced with all the young men, and I felt pangs of jealousy. The musical messages of the hope, the pain of love, and of love lost and found touched my adolescent heart. When I left the party to meet my 11 p.m. curfew, she hung on to my jacket, imploring me to stay longer. I can feel the lingering farewell kiss she planted on my lips, her arms embracing me closely. I floated home with the Everly Brothers' refrain, "Never knew what I missed until I kissed her. How did I exist until I kissed her?" ringing through my head. We remained occasional pen pals for the next 3 years. I attempted to visit her, but the Hungarian communist authorities would not grant me a visa. That autumn term, 1/3 of the class were girls, and they were smart, multilingual, and came from affluent families. Among them was Shiem Shafi, a very bright, smart, good-looking Egyptian, the daughter of my parents' friends, both of whom were physicians at the university. Prior to my dad's death, he, mother, and I had gone to their house for dinner. The conversation revolved around Shiem and me. Both families agreed that we would make an excellent couple for eventual marriage. We became friendlier during class, but I never felt the same sensations of passion and longing I had for Kinga, or the same thrill when I saw her on a daily basis in class. Perhaps it would have turned out very well had an arranged marriage taken place in the absence of passion. My future in Egypt would have been secure under such a union, and my anxiety would have evaporated. Perhaps. But it wasn't what I had imagined my future would hold.